And up next is the April 11th, Thursday, 2019 edition of Bathrob Spears Broadsides, the show which has me doing a lot of talking and a lot of interviewing around civil rights for homeless folks and stuff like that. So this last week there was a shitty council meeting, as I like to call our city council, around the latest proposal to essentially thin out and move along the Ross camp, given the fact that they don't have adequate shelter and never have had, never intended to, but like to lie about it through their city manager spokespeople, Susie O'Hara, Tina Schull, and Martin Brunel, the city manager, of course, himself. Personable, dense misinformation by these folks. Optimistic assessments of shelter that will be available first on March 15th, the first closure date for the Ross camp, the second April 17th. Now they had Cynthia Matthews trying for April 30th. And the latest one is one proposed by Justin Cummings, voted by the council, which essentially allows a sort of an indefinite closure date, but an assertion that that's their intention, or their intention and their desire to do it, but that they are waiting until they get the adequate shelter, and after then they're going to clean up the camp in the meantime. Although there's no provision in removing people from the camp for the cleanup to provide any adequate shelter for them during that period of time. To me, that's kind of the nub of recent activism that I've been involved in. Plus, of course, the famous, or actually not famous yet, but soon perhaps to be famous, lawsuit filed by the Ross Camp residents, the Ross Camp Council, including Sweat, Desiree, Shannon, and numerous other folks living there who are asserting their rights under the Martin versus Boise decision to be left alone until and unless there are some alternatives, so they don't have to be carrying everything around on their backs, struggling to find a place to sleep each night. Many around them, perhaps even more disabled than they are, facing the same situation. Just because it was not mentioned at city council at all, really, except for a brief mention by the city attorney, and also the attempt of Mayor Watkins to cut off any communications between the city council member Drew Glover and Alicia Kuhl, who's the Ross Camp Council liaison, and was in the audience and willing to answer questions about misinformation being provided by a number of people, including Susie O'Hara, to the city council. Let me name the actual defendants, or I should say plaintiffs, since they're suing the city. Desiree Quintero, Santos Mendez, Michael Sweat, Sony Lopez, Rafael Sandana, Crystal Olson, Vanessa Montoya, Juan Macedo, Mark Hammerbach, Shannon Vadmuska, and a number of others similarly situated. These are residents of the Ross homeless encampment located behind Ross at the Gateway Plaza in Santa Cruz, California. This is for a preliminary injunction against the city of Santa Cruz, which includes the Santa Cruz City Council, Santa Cruz City Manager Martin Brunel, Santa Cruz City Management Analyst Susie O'Hara, and Santa Cruz City Manager Tina Schull. Those are the defendants. What they're trying to be enjoined against is the unlawful closure of the Ross homeless encampment that was slated to be closed on April 17th, 2019, located behind Ross in the Gateway Plaza in Santa Cruz, California. Before we do any more, let's get into the show.
I'm tired of moon songs, of star and of June songs. They simply make me nap. And ditties romantic drive me nearly frantic. I think they're all full of pap. History's making, nations are quaking. Why sing of stars above? For while we are waiting, Father Time's creating new things to be singing of. Sing me a song with social significance. All other tunes are taboo. I want a ditty with heat in it. appealing with feeling and meat in it. Sing me a song with social significance, or you can sing till you're blue. Let meaning shine from every line, or I won't love you.
So now let's turn back to actually where we left off on Sunday. This has a longer show. I have a longer show on Sunday. Lasts for about, well, can last for up to 5.5 hours, but usually it's 2 to 3.5 hours. One of the things that I played on there was a conversation about homelessness in Santa Cruz, a community meeting run by council member and Project Pollinator, that's the name of his group, Drew Glover. And he held this in response to a community outrage around the somewhat manufactured community outrage, as far as I felt, but around the issue of the choosing of the Depot Park as a gone-by-dawn safe sleeping spot by the Santa Cruz City Council, intent on cooking up something fast so they could close Ross Camp on April 17th, or at least appear to have the shelter to close Ross Camp and so evade the restrictions of the Martin versus Boise decision, the guarantees that that decision provides for homeless people, that they will simply not be shoveled off the street into the nearest manure pit, so to speak. I played the first half of Glover's community meeting, which was, there were a lot more favorable voices than I had previously suspected would get there, and some favorable voices from a meeting the previous evening that we held in defense of the Ross Camp with plans to find resistance strategies if police were actually going to move in and force people to make a journey to nowhere with all their possessions. Room at the Depot Park area, or the Depot Station, I guess it was called, had about 60, 70, 80 people, two council members, Matthews and Glover. Matthews sat primly in the back, as she usually does. Not in the back, but she's usually quite prim, that's my impression. But there were the Ross Camp Council, or a few members of the Ross Camp Council, including the Ross Camp liaison, Alice Cool. Anyway, we're going to join this conversation a bit in the midst of it. I'm not going to play all of it because you can now find it online thanks to the work of activist Wes White, who's with the Salinas Community Homeless Alliance. I guess it's called the Monterey County Homeless Alliance, and the statewide California Homeless Union, which he has been traveling around the state, urging people in different communities to join, and he's going to be doing another trip up to Chico and Marysville and Paradise, perhaps. I'm not sure if he's actually getting to Paradise where they had the fire. If you're interested in that, give a call to me at 423-HUFF, 423-4833. HUFF is Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom. It's also the letter version of my phone number, 423-4833. And I'll put you in touch with Wes, who probably has it. He has a direct phone number, too, but it's longer, and I don't want to force you to try to rush and get a pencil and write it down. If you're interested in this issue, he's got a lot of stuff online under the YouTube designation John, J-O-H-N, and then the second word is Doe13K, D-O-E-13K, all one word. And you'll find a lot of his videos, the most recent one being this community meeting, a conversation about homelessness in Santa Cruz. And it's probably more watchable than this particular audio is listenable. Maybe because he has better recording facility, maybe because it's video and visual. But anyway, I'll play some of it and then move on to something else. So here we go. This is Crystal of the
Ross Camp Council. What's your name? What do you want to talk about tonight? Who are you guys?
My name is Wilson, and I'm sorry I'm late. I just got off work. I'm in the Ross City Council. No longer at Ross. I am in a shelter that has no rules, no curfew, no drug test, and I have proceeded to use my 2 weeks that I've been there on my own. Yay. To use that as a stepping stone and get a job, which I've done. You know, it's amazing what you can do when you have a shower every day. And you know, I'm working really hard with a few and we are a work in progress. It's been raining, and so I understand it looks like a real mess, but we've had meetings with the fire chief and been accountable and done everything that we've been asked in a timely manner, and you know, I just feel like, why would you have us have a meeting with the fire chief to get these fire lanes in the Ross camp if you're going to close it down?
What's your name and whatever you want to talk about tonight, or you can ask.
My name's Taylor. I'm just here to listen and give support. I'm a full-time student and just thought I'd open my presence a little bit.
All right. Wow. So that was wonderful. Thank you, everybody.
This is Drew Glover.
The chorus of voices and perspectives. So we heard a lot of stuff that ran the gamut from public safety to the rights and not the humanization of people to the need for public health concerns to the support for transitional encampments, the support for the Ross camp, to I have an extensive list here. So we'll go back to those topics in just a second. I want to start by giving you a rundown of what I'm currently doing in the process of things, because there were some questions about timeline, what's been going on, what's happening, because it has been moving. In relationship to the speed that's been moving with homelessness.
And let me interrupt by noting this was a conversation that happened a week ago on Thursday the 4th, April 4th. So since then, he has met with us, Drew Glover has met with some of us out at the Ross camp. He has a regular Monday meeting. There'll be another one coming up on the 15th at 4 o'clock. And there, of course, has been the city council where he was outvoted in a somewhat, he tried to present a proposal that I suggested he make. I may be playing that today or on Sunday. Last Monday, I made a proposal that he make the next day at the city council that any attempt to do a so-called cleanup of the camp be done in place, that people not have to leave the campsite to do it, that they also be a part of it, that it not be a case of evacuating the area in order to do the cleaning and then hopefully being told to come back, because I find myself, and I think others were also suspicious, that this could well be just simply a get out now and maybe we'll thin you out and maybe we'll let a limited number of people back. But it was not, in other words, there was no provision for there being alternate shelter for people during this so-called cleanup provision. I asked him to guarantee that in his resolution. I don't think he ever made that resolution. He may have talked around it. He may have made some attempts to do something to that effect. There was a lot of blockage from the city attorney and the mayor procedurally at a number of points in the city council meeting. And there were some victories by the city council, which I think I'll also talk about maybe on Sunday, maybe today. I'm not sure. It depends on kind of how much I see getting done or hear getting done, and you'll hear it with me. Although a lot of this, I'm just going to kind of let it rip, and you can follow it as you wish, perhaps with your afternoon or evening cup of coffee or whatever you're drinking. Let's hear some more.
In the past, we have been moving very quickly over the last 3 months to move things forward. So when you walked in, there was a packet on the table over there. I only printed 50 of them because I didn't know how many people were going to be here. So if you didn't receive one, you can sign up in our newsletter page right there, and you'll get full digital versions of all of them. And as you came in, also there were two of these. Someone took the other 17-inch one, but that's okay. This is the one that I wanted to focus on, and this is the three steps, essentially, that I'm working on to address homelessness in Santa Cruz. And so the three steps are shelter and affordable housing, public health and safety, and the prevention and stability of current housing in Santa Cruz. So what you've been experiencing so far has been step one, which is the establishment of shelter. There was a statement about the declaration of shelter emergency being rushed through when someone was talking about what they wanted to talk about. I just want to provide some clarity on that. There has been a declaration of shelter emergency on the books in the city. city of Santa Cruz since January of 2018.
Yep.
So that was far before what we decided on a couple of council meetings ago with regards to the declaration of shelter emergency. The only thing that we were doing was not only renewing it and making it so that it would continue moving forward, but also adding some additional language in it that would make it so that we could more expeditiously establish transitional encampments to work around zoning regulations, which makes it so that we can bypass, say, the planning department and having to go through the planning department to then establish a transitional encampment, but we can still have public meetings and hearings, which are the city council meetings, that allow y'all to come and express your thoughts, concerns, or feelings about a specific location for a transitional encampment. The transitional encampments themselves, this is another area of confusion that I want to make sure, because it was said in a couple of statements when people were talking, is that the proposed programs, the safe sleeping programs, the safe parking programs, and the transitional encampment models are not the Ross camp. I just want to stress that as heavily as I can, is that the models are completely different in the sense that they incorporate sets of regulations and rules, requirements for residents to be able to participate and live in the space, as well as they're data-driven. So the Ross Camp right now has no official management structure, it has no nonprofit that's the kind of the overseeing, overarching people that are helping to maintain the structure. There's no main security gate in and out, there's no residential list of who's in the camp right now to be able to understand what population is in there in general. All of those things are incorporated in transitional encampments. And then not only that, like I mentioned before, they're data-driven. So this proposal wasn't something that me and a group of individuals just one day said, hey, let's do transitional encampments in Santa Cruz. They're based off of models that have been successful in moving people into transitional housing, permanent supportive housing, as well as services that include substance use disorder and mental health services. So they have higher rates of getting people into those than other non-managed encampments. And it makes it so that there's the issue of safety in the neighborhoods that people brought up. So transitional encampments have shown that when in the neighborhoods that they're established, there is no increase in crime. In fact, because of the buy-in that the transitional encampments develop from the structure of the way that they're put together, the people in the camp actually act as security for that surrounding neighborhood because there is an incorporation of required participation in the camp. So,
and I got to say that anecdotally, I've heard this to be true in a number of Santa Cruz encampments, such as Camp Paradise, where there was community buy-in back in 2000. This was a campsite under the Highway 1 bridge, a bit beyond the Highway 1 bridge, on the upriver side of it, that lasted for about 9 months. And it was done in the opposition, not by the neighborhood there, but by the city council, which was ironically a progressive or liberal city council. Perhaps not so ironically, it's often been the case that liberals can often be just as vehement, if not more so, than conservatives in their opposition to homeless presence and homeless civil rights. They simply disguise it differently, and they use different language when talking about it. I don't really have an honest, clear, and extensive body of evidence showing that transitional camps are, A, that they're transitioning anywhere, because there's no real housing generally for people to transition to, or that even there's a lesser crime rate generally in the areas where there are transitional camps. So I haven't heard the opposite either. So I say this simply because I don't want the fact that Drew Glover's claims, often like Brent Adams' claims, are being played on my show to indicate I necessarily agree with him. I hope he's right. And I also think it's also a matter of sort of basic civil rights for poor people that is my primary issue and concern. But I want to be also factually evident, rather should we say factually accurate about these issues. So I don't claim to facts that aren't in existence. I'm not really a big fan of nonprofit-run transitional camps in terms of how they nanny out or infantilize or in their own way criminalize the poor people that get into them and serve as the excuses that cities use to go after people who are outside those very limited kinds of programs. whether it's in Seattle or Portland or elsewhere. I'm much more sympathetic to homeless-run, homeless-initiated encampments, even if they're more rough-hewn in their approach, even if they are wet camps as well. Now, that's me from my perch inside a rented room or set of rooms, and I'm obviously in a privileged position there. So for folks who are, and I'm not living right next to a homeless encampment or a even a homeless program or a halfway house, although I have in the past, and I haven't had any real problem. My lifestyle, though, is less concerned with at least standard material stuff. I've got my own material addictions, no question about it, but perhaps not the same kind of, gee, is my property increasing in value? I don't have any property in that way. So, in any case, it just seems to me that a notion of transitional encampments, which has been dumped by the city council in spite of Glover's concerns, in spite of, I think, it's a very reasonable alternative for emergency shelters. There's no question about that. It's cheaper. There's more liberty for the people involved. There's more privacy. There's more dignity. It seems to me a better alternative. And it's really, given the reality, there are a lot of structures that could be used for indoor shelters, but since that's not likely to happen in the near future because of property values and so forth, outdoor transitional encampments or gone by dawn stuff, which I'm less supportive of, but better than arresting people for ticketing and ticketing them on the streets for doing what they need to do at night. Anyway, let's hear some more from Drew discussing this, having made that long sort of aside.
So that means that people that are in the camp receiving shelter are required to conduct between 4 to 10 hours a week of participatory labor, essentially, or sweat equity in the property. So this could take the form of running the main entrance gate. This could take the form of doing trash perimeter cleanups. This could take the form of running security. The key is that they're all trained by the nonprofit.
And I'm no fan of slave labor as a condition of entry into a camp either. So we have some differences, Drew and I, if that's his advocacy proposal.
This in itself has created, like I mentioned before, a sense of buy-in and pride. If you're building something, you have pride in wanting to make sure that it's successful. If someone just gives you something, then it's easy to trash it, throw it away, not care about it. But if you feel a sense of ownership in something that you're doing, a sense of pride in your community, statistically, those people within the camps have taken it upon themselves to kind of self, and when I say this, people get this good misconstrued. When I say self-managed, I do not mean that there is no oversight management. When I say self-managed, I mean that there is an overseeing management nonprofit, but that the people in the camp participate in the management process.
And again, this, of course, is far from a democratic, autonomous, self-run model that he's suggesting. It seems more like an attempt to kind of do what I've accused Brent Adams of doing at times, which is cater to a more conservative community that is worried about, has stereotypes around homeless people, and believes they have to be controlled like wild animals, that imposing restrictions on them that they, housed people, would never accept themselves, limitations on their privacy and dignity that housed people would not accept in their own lives, but that they feel should be imposed upon the other. So I'm not a fan of some of this, but I'm playing it for you because, sadly, or realistically, Glover is the most progressive, liberal, reasonable of all the council members, at least on these issues. And unfortunately, that only goes so far.
So it takes away this paternalistic energy as well. They're not little kids that need to be watched, but instead they're active and participating members of that community. That was step one. right? And that's just establishing the shelter options, because in Santa Cruz there has not been the option to establish transitional encampments or manage encampments up until now. And so we're able to start looking at these models, identifying locations, working with nonprofits, and creating these structured communities that can incorporate organic gardens, they can incorporate all kinds of different things that allow people to kind of uplift themselves. So establishing transitional encampments. Next, under that affordable shelter and affordable housing, is identifying additional funding sources for affordable housing. So who here knows about the TOT? Show your hands. Okay, stands for Transient Occupancy Tax. It's a tax that's put on hotels and other things that have to do with tourism and vacationing. I spoke with the city finance director. For every 1% that we increase our TOT, which right now is arguably rather low, we generate about $1.7 million into the general fund that could be used for affordable housing development. So we can look at alternative revenue streams, like looking at the TOT, like looking at things like real estate transfer tax, like looking at speculation tax. So, or vacancy tax, right? Because what was mentioned before with the census.
I'm no opponent to any of these taxes, but I am an opponent to misleadingly talking about affordable housing, which is not affordable even to working class people in this city, much less to low income, very low income, or homeless folks. So that, to me, is something that always comes up at city council, and that is fundamentally a phony label that's used to encourage developers to develop their own market rate housing with a few so-called affordable housing units thrown in, or maybe a few low-income units. And, of course, even for people who have subsidized housing, it's really hard to find people who accept Section 8 vouchers, or at least I certainly hear a lot of controversy on that issue.
Is that there's a lot of vacant houses, a lot of second homes. So there's a lot of opportunity for us to be looking at ways. Like, for example, Berkeley. Berkeley has a speculation or real estate transfer tax of 12%. Santa Cruz, 1.2%. So there's a lot of opportunity for us to look at the ways that we have our financial system structured and how we can generate additional money for affordable housing. But then the question is, well, what about the affordable housing? Where are we going to build? That is the next thing, is creating a city land trust. Because if the city can start acquiring properties and then developing those properties into higher density facilities run by a third-party nonprofit, then the city can take Section 8 vouchers. Because one of the hardest things we have in Santa Cruz is getting landlords to take Section 8 vouchers, which is hard to believe, because Section 8 vouchers basically are guaranteed rent for that landlord because it's coming from the federal government. But there is a stigma attached to Section 8 vouchers because of the low-income reality of people. They don't want to get stuck with a low-income person that they don't like or that they feel is going to be a hoarder, or all these other excuses that people have for not taking Section 8 vouchers. So not only can we encourage landlords through the more carrot model of encouraging them to take Section 8 vouchers and figuring out ways to make that more important or more attractive, but also, to open up city or government-owned housing to be able to accept that Section 8 vouchers through a city land trust. Okay, so that's step one.
Notice there's no discussion of taking over vacant housing or legitimizing squats that have happened in abandoned housing. So this is hardly a very radical proposal. If you think Glover is a radical, think again.
Step two is public health and safety. So we heard a lot about that, whether it be public safety and feeling safe walking around neighborhoods or people stealing things from properties, or whether it be public health with needle exchange or the lack of needle exchange or the issue of drug addiction, which from this point forward I'm going to start using the term substance use disorder instead of addiction, because we want to start changing the language around that. So, who here knows about Janus? Show hands. Okay, who here knows about Janus and its funding problems? Show hands. Oh, way less. Okay, so Janus is in an incredible pickle right now, because they have amazing staff and amazing nurses, but they don't have enough money to pay them a living wage. So we're losing a lot of them. In fact, we have a representative from Janus and the National Union of Healthcare Workers with us today. So would you like to come join me? Right. We're happy to have you here. Yes. Thank you for joining. Yes, exactly. So, you don't have to talk if you don't want to.
I don't.
Yeah. More than you can do the talking, you can just be there with that awesome hand. So, yes, I'm going to let them talk about what's going on with JMS 10 and what we can do, but it's important to realize, because in your little frequently asked questions page that I gave you that looks like this, there's a question of what is the city going to do about drug addiction and mental health issues, which is a question I get a lot of the time, and my short answer is unfortunately not much, because that area, and this is where it got back to the city and the county pointing fingers at each other, is that the county is required to do health and substance use disorder work. They're the ones that have issued the funding to Janus. And there's a video that's online, which I'd be happy to share with you, of a Janus, of Janus workers in general, pleading to the county board of supervisors to increase their funding, and she'll tell you why. Whatever you want to share.
My perspective.
Yeah.
So
who are you?
My name is Sadie Smith. I'm a treatment tech at Janus. Started out at Main Campus, which is a residential treatment center and a detox unit. Right now I'm at perinatal, mostly full-time there, and that is moms and babies. I'm taking care of moms who are, most of them have open CPS investigations, and we're trying to help them be better moms and kind of we're also opening up a program to help them build their families back so that they can have custody of their children. At any rate, what I want to talk to you about is the parity in care with substance use disorder and mental health. I would like to see that change. Janus, it would be wonderful to see Janus employees trained in both dual diagnosis for mental health treatment as well as substance use disorder, because most of the clients that we see have a mental health diagnosis along with their substance use disorder diagnosis. We just have a lack of funding for mental health in our community. We have county mental health, but we see a lot of people fall through the cracks. As far as that goes, the jails end up treating these clients for mental health, and they're not equipped to do so.
And I'm afraid this, and I was here for this, recording it, although I'm now giving you the audio track of the YouTube video by Wes White of the community meeting conversation about homelessness in Santa Cruz by Drew Glover. I found myself kind of nodding out as she talked. I think the main key point to me was Janus just isn't properly funded. And so people who tell you, oh, these junkies all need to go get treatment, stop giving them needles and start arresting them and forcing them into treatment is sort of the line of people online. If you go to read the Sentinel's website and you go to the discus section, which is the comments section of the Sentinel website, you'll see a lot of this really pretty naked bigotry, or let's say strong opinion, if you don't want to characterize it as bigotry, that all these people need to do is come clean, and that they're just a bunch of junkies otherwise, and a bunch of thieves, and pretty much that's it. But this dialogue that interested me was not the kind of standard, it's kind of, it looks like a Janus ad wrap we're getting here, which is full of technical terminology, and I'm no fan. I don't think any of these mental health professionals have any solutions for mental health, frankly. That's my general reaction. I mean, to me, mental health is a life crisis that comes up, and there are all kinds of different things that need to be done. Usually it has to do with the pressures and stresses and the social and the family situations that people are in. The whole idea of it being some kind of chemical imbalance in the brain was discredited in the 80s, and the whole massive pharmaceutical treatment of mental health, to me, is a major, terribly toxic hoax that's being perpetrated on the country. And so I don't have a lot of patience for it. You've heard me invite in onto my show and have onto my show activists like Robert Whitaker, the author of Mad in America, who I hope to have on again, if I can ever get through his third or fourth book. He goes into pretty great detail on the scientific evidence or lack of evidence around the claims that pharmaceuticals are actually a good first solution for so-called mental illness diagnoses. The Janice worker talks about a high turnover of employees as well, about an anti-union management, lots of talk about better training, better patient outcomes across the board, and again, I kind of find myself nodding out listening to her, and so I'm not subjecting you to her. The cost or the budget, which is a key question, she has no answer. She's reading from a book. Question about, does it cost more to house people in jail or in Janus, the drug treatment program? And she guesses it would be costing more to house them in jail, but that's not terribly helpful. Remember the audience who raises a question.
So we have a for-profit corporation that runs the medical in the jail, California Forensic Medical Group. They run 28 of the county's medical care for jails. They provide substandard care. So the reason that you have a disconnect at the jail from people actually getting help is that the medical care is provided by a for-profit corporation. The mental health is provided by the county. Those two entities do not intersect, okay? And then Janice runs the sobering center. And unfortunately, you have medical assistants and EMTs running a sobering center where they maybe get 8 hours if someone is completely intoxicated to convince them to maybe seek treatment after, which we all know that's not a good time to try to get somebody to seek treatment when they're detoxing and they're not even detoxed. So it starts with the jail, because let's be honest, the jail is the mental health facility, and it is the end result of, if you get picked up at Camp Ross or anywhere else for doing drugs or petty crime, where do you end up? You end up in the jail. So
speaking to that, I have a client that I've spoken to recently. He said that he was suffering an alcohol crisis and it wasn't being addressed at the point he was incarcerated in our jail.
Yeah.
And he suffered tremendously. And I said, okay, well, I'm going to do whatever I can to change that. So, I mean, yeah, honestly, this is why I'm coming back to work for Janice. I really wanted to change it from then. Yeah. But it's going to take the community to do that unilaterally.
I was one person at the county board of meetings, so I don't see these people show up when the budget hearings are happening and see how
they see which people.
The county board of supervisors runs these programs. So if you go and there's one person there advocating and they look at you like you're the crazy one person in the community, and the knowledge is out there. We keep re-upping their contract after multiple debts. So I don't understand where the disconnect is, but if the information is not out there, everybody knows.
And so that's one of the great things about this meeting and why I hope will come from it, is that now people that are concerned about these concepts of mental health and substance use issues, but are looking at the city to make that change happen, if you can redirect your energy, connect with Melissa, connect with people that are working in the mental health and substance use disorder fields, and join your power to support the National Union of Healthcare Workers Union locally here for Janice, support the increase of funding from the county level so that we can make sure we can open more beds and have the quality of care that's required. Because as a healthcare worker described to me, it's a hearing your thing, is paying low wages impacts workers, and that impacts the quality of care. The lower quality of care impacts the patient's success, and then that increases the people experiencing homelessness with mental health or substance use disorder. So it's all connected with regards
to the low wage. Creates an apathetic work environment. So then you have treatment techs, which I am, and then you have counselors that are just apathetic, and maybe a client will come in with a very complicated case, and it'll just be too complicated. They don't want to deal with it. I'm not getting paid enough to deal with this. I honestly end up, and I am not the only staff person that does this, but people that really care will pick up the slack. They'll do extra. They'll do work on their days off. Right now, I'm going to work on getting a client housing. There's a housing crisis.
So then hear more of how Janice workers are working very hard. I'm going to skip ahead a little bit and then encourage you, if you are interested in this dialogue, to check in on the video version of it. Just go to YouTube, John Doe 13K, and then look up Community Meeting, A Conversation About Homelessness in Santa Cruz, and you can catch the whole thing.
Thank you. I just wanted to say, could we say when the
supervisor's meeting is, because people need to go to those as well as city council. Are those Wednesday mornings at 9?
Tuesday
mornings at 9.
Well, so working people can't go.
Right? Well, anybody here who can go is who I'm talking to.
Yeah.
Can.
Look on their website. Supervisor website.
So I didn't know about the county being responsible for that kind of funding, and I'm wondering, is there a prohibition against the city also keeping financing for some of these programs?
So the money in the budget, they have a much larger budget than the city does with regards to being able to allocate money for that kind of health care and services. And it's just not in the, I mean, when you talk to city staff and other city representatives, they say, well, it's not in the city charter or the description of the city. If we're here to do the services or the roads and all this other kind of stuff, the county is the one that's supposed to do that. So we have to pressure the county and contact the county supervisors. We'll go here, and then I want to make sure that I can let everyone know about some of the other things to address the issues.
Just real quick, the county and the city just got handed $10 million as a grant.
Thank you.
Why can't Janice get some of that money? Because that grant is to help the homeless. Well, I bet you a lot of people that Janice deals with are homeless. Why can't they get a chunk of that to either pay their employees better or open more beds or all of the above?
So the there, if you look at the Sentinel, they have a breakdown of where all the money went. It's a lot of different places. A million. It's amazing how fast $10 million go when it's broken up between things. $1 million of it did come to the city for specifically focusing on emergency shelter options and the implementation of these different things, and also some other property purchases. But it did get dispersed rather quickly, and I'm curious because I don't remember seeing Janice being listed on there for additional funding, but I have to check the actual rundown. Carol?
I just had several conversations with board supervisors because I wanted to ask the same question. So where's the money going? Why can't go to substance abuse? What I was told, and I actually put it up on Nextdoor today, they doubled their beds, which is still not enough for Medi-Cal, drug, and alcohol. And there was a list of people or organizations that got the money. You had to apply for the money. It wasn't just given to people randomly. And I also found out that, because I was specifically asking about safe parking, that outside of the city limits, the county has established 17 safe parking areas. So I asked Ryan Coonerty, where are they? And he said he'd get back to me. Car parking places outside of the city limits.
That's why, because they're only 3 to 5 cars.
They're at church, yes.
And so with that, and then I'll come back here, there's a couple things I want to touch on really quick, and then we'll come back here to both of y'all. Did you have something you want to say too? Someone asked about what's going on with the planning. You don't hear much from the county, you don't hear much from the city. The structure of the way that the county and the city are interacting.
And before he gets into that, or actually perhaps instead of getting into that, the business with churches is that while churches in theory can provide safe parking spaces at night for people in vehicles, very few of them do, either in the city or the county. There are a few. I would say 6 to 12 in my experience in the last 20 or 25 years have. Usually no more than 2 or 3 spaces. And there have been a couple of exceptions. I think one church has actually hosted and continues to host the residue of Camp Paradise, which I talked about earlier. It's out in the Aptos area. I'm going to leave this conversation now, but again invite you to check it out. Go to YouTube, John Doe 13K, Community Meeting, a conversation about homelessness in Santa Cruz. If you want to hear more, what's inspiring about it is the fact that Drew Glover, though he does take up the lion's share of the discussion and manages it and runs it, does seem to make a real effort to let people speak and answer their questions, or to acknowledge he has no answers to their questions. I don't always like his answers. He doesn't always fulfill his commitments. In fact, I find that to be almost a universal problem with these politicians. But nonetheless, this is one of the few open forums where there's actually some access and real dialogue. I'm not sure how effective it is or where it goes that I've seen. Let's go musical.